religious communes. The art of meditation is developed by the Hasidic masters. Now, this interest in Hasidism is not unique, not a response to some emphasis that I've placed on it in the course. I'm told that outside the gates of the campus of UCLA, that the Bollinger living, the disciples of the Hasidic group, began years ago in Lubavitch in Eastern Europe, whose ancestors continue the rather missionary approach to Hasidism of this particular group. These people have established a house, a whole open house for the students on the campus, that each Sabbath afternoon several hundred Jewish students come, sit cross-legged on the floor and sway to the wordless chants of Hasidim.
Right.
after the Cossacks had erupted from the Ukraine and moved across the hinterland, the heartland of Jewish Eastern Europe and murdered 1 in 3. It was a denial of the outside world and a search for integrity, a search for what joy could be found in life in the world within. And it sought to find this joy in community, in fellowship, in fraternity, in turning to one's better self and drawing out the love, the better self in someone else. It spoke of immunity. It spoke of commune. It spoke of feeling. It admitted openly the dark, churning passions within, but spoke of the possibility of finding the brighter passions and of sharing these with another. Recently, Dr. Charles Reich of Yale University has made something of a splash with a book which he called The Green of America. Some of you may have read it. Among other things, it's an attempt to describe the inner world, the perspective on life as the many in the college generation, Dr. Reich feels, sees it. He speaks of various levels of consciousness. And he says that the young people have come to a level which he calls consciousness 3. And by this he means a world in which they have rejected the outside world, turned away from it, it is too cold, too dispassionate, too impersonal. They want nothing of the status-oriented, achievement-oriented society. They want the world within. They want to find the best within themselves, the best within another, and have meaning, community, sympathy, passion, concern. Well, I submit that there are a great number of similarities between consciousness 3 and classicism 1. Between the old and the new. I'd like to draw some of these out for you this morning. Before I do, I'd like to take a step back into history to point out two things. One, that it is surprising that the young people should turn to Hasidism. Two, what kind of Hasidism or what understanding of Hasidism they are in fact turning to. A myth or a reality? The world as it was, or what they assume that world to have been. Many of you come from homes where learning was prized. If you do, you'll remember that on your shelves, in all probability, there were 6 thick volumes published in the late 19th century, the 1890s, by Heinrich Gretz, which were an English translation of his great German history, Geschichte der Juden, a history of the Jews. Dr. Gretz's work represented the culmination, the summing up, of the first 100 years of academic, critical Jewish self-awareness. Instead of folklores, instead of legends, instead of midrash, he attempted from a university perspective to write critical history. And when he turned to the Hasidim, to these figures who are so romantic to our young people, this is what Dr. Gretz had to say. There arose in Poland a new Essenism of the Essenes, which with forms similar to those of the ancient cult, with ablutions and baths, white garments, miraculous cures, and prophetic visions. Like the old movement, it originated in ultra-piety, but soon turned against its own parent. It seems remarkable that the time when Mendelssohn declared rational thought to be the essence of Judaism, and founded as it were a widely extended order of enlightened men, another banner was unfurled, the adherents of which announced the gross superstition to be the fundamental principle of Judaism, and formed an order of wonder-seeking confederates. The founders of the new Hasidism were Israel of Mejibuz and Bera Meserich. The former received alike from his admirers and his antagonists the surname of the Wonder Worker by means of invocation of the name of God. Baal Shem, or Baal Shem Tov, is the customary abbreviated form of Besht. As ugly as the name Besht was the form of the founder, the order that he called into existence. The Graces did not sit by his crib. perverted belief in wonder working, and his brain was so filled with fantastic images that he could not distinguish them from real, tangible beings. On. What we have in Dr. Gretz's history is the typical liberal's attitude towards the scrubby, towards the poor, towards the semi-literate, towards the fundamentalist, towards revival meetings, towards those who turn to a faith healer rather than to a physician, towards those who deny their youngsters admission to a secular state school, towards those who marry off their daughters when they're 11 and 12, towards those who insist that a secular book must not be read, that the only books which are permissible are those from the tradition, the Orthodox and Hasidic, towards those, in other words, who live not in the real world as a Dr. Gretz understands it, but in a world of their own, walled in from the sun as he saw it, darkened by the grossest forms of superstition. And the Hasidic world was poor. And the Hasidic world was ridden with superstition. And in the Hasidic world, men did turn to their tzaddikim, to their wonder-working leaders, for amulets and for charms and for superstitions and for faith healing, for all kinds of magical achievements. The world of Dr. Gretz, the liberal, humane world which sets such a value on education, on discipline, on control, on reorganizing the terms of society, produced, among other things, modern anti-Semitism, produced, among other things, the World War, produced, among other things, Auschwitz, and of course produced men who began to look beyond the word the mass, the word proletariat, the world superstitious, the word obscurantist, to look at the inner life of these people, see if there wasn't something there that modern man could find and give meaning to. History is always an attempt to find in the past that which refracts our own attitudes and our own prejudices. And the 20th century has given up on the romantic histories of the past. Histories of wars, histories of kings and princes and noblemen, and has found the glory of the past in the so-called uncommon common man. It has tried to mine the meaning of myth and folklore and folk legend and folk music and folk history. And so, in the 20th century, a whole group of men, most prominent of them, the philosopher Martin Buber, began to re-examine, as if from within, the inner life of the Hasidim, and to present to us a different kind of understanding of these poor, these huddled masses who had turned away from the 19th century, who had turned away from science and technology and the world of the establishment, turned in on themselves. Cecil Roth is perhaps to our generation what Heinrich Gretz was to his, a world-renowned historian whose understanding reflects the best in the historical traditions of our century. Let me read you the parallel paragraph in Roth's history to Gretz's. A more remote effect of the Messianic stir was the birth of Hasidism. The revivalist movement in Poland permeated all the sections of society, till it touched a simple Praetorian line digger, Israel Ben Eliezer. The cycle of legends which has gathered about the latter's personality has made it difficult to realize the exact import of his teachings. It is clear, nevertheless, that this man of the people revolted against the hegemony of intellect which had hitherto prevailed undisputed among the Polish Jews. Where learning had been considered fundamental to Judaism, consideration was withheld from any person who was not a profound Talmudist. The new leader, a tender-hearted mystic of rare personal magnetism, taught that piety was superior to scholarship, and that it was the prerogative of any man, however ignorant and however poor, to long as his worship was carried out with joy and gladness. Men could derive no advantage from the mortification of the flesh. It was by spiritual exaltation, complete abandonment of self, that the gulf between earth and heaven would be bridged. On the other hand, there exist a certain righteous one, Sennacherib, who are close to the Almighty, whose intercession might sometimes sway his immutable will. Here we have a world not laden with a pejorative adjective, a world in which we sense grace and spiritual enlightenment and meaning and love and need and meeting. I sometimes wonder as I read these histories, you know, will the real Hasidic world please stand up? Now, it's clear that both Gretz and Roth were reacting to a reality and to their own need. It's clear that the young people today turn to Hasidism, turn to it and read it, read about it, rather, in the beautifully formed prose of the Martin Buber, his tales of the Hasidic masters, is the meaning of God and Hasidism in a dozen books that he wrote on the subject. They find something of the Hasidic world in the tales of Adnan, who so recently won the Nobel Prize. They find much of it in the novels and novella of a man like Isaac Bashevis, the singer. They turn to a world, in other words, which they don't have to see or smell or know. They turn to people whom they don't have to meet in order to find the meaning of meaning, of meeting. They turn to a world whose reality, whose obscurantism, whose illiteracy, whose ignorance is not part of the printed page. And they react simply to an understanding by sensitive Western scholars of the spiritual, cultural, and psychological meaning of that world. They react to a disembodied world as it was. And I think as we proceed with this analysis, I'd like you to keep this in mind. They are reacting not to people so much as to a body of ideas. They're not in the klaus, dancing back and forth with Hasidim, but in their own circle, dancing with their own, to a record, a long-playing modern scientific technical achievement on the Victrola, not to the rather sometimes unmusical sound made by the assembled voices of the Hasidim. What do they find in this world? They find in the first instance a rich folklore, a rich set of symbolic ideas around which they can form their own apperceptions of life. Like the Hasidic world, the world of consciousness three, world of some of these young people begins in a turning off in anger against the outside world. The world of policy, the world of power, the world of finance, the world of war, the world of the factory, the world of the machine, the world of the automobile and of the highway, all that makes for the daily reality. The Second World War in Vietnam, are to consciousness three what Chmielnitsky and the pogroms were to the Hasidim. And they looked for reality, for a confirmation that there is meaning to life, for a sense of joy in this blackness. They look within, not without. They deny the possibility of climbing the greasy pole. They deny the meaningfulness of getting to the top of the pole simply to manipulate the bits of power which exist in our world. That's not enough. Salvation, deliverance, meaning to life, comes only when one has touched another life, when one has had the very depths of his own being exposed to beauty, exposed to feeling, exposed to compassion, as well as to passion. So both these worlds begin in a tuning out of the world we assume, most of us, to be the real world. evidence against the military-industrial complex in the case of the Hasidim against the rabbinic complex, against all those scholars and teachers who had organized communities and taught them that it is only through learning, only through mastery of the book, of the Talmud, that one gains power, status, meaning, credit, brownie points with God. Hasidic literature is full of anger against those who are in power, particularly those whose power depends upon scholarship because they were the semi-literate, against those whose power depends upon wealth because these were the poor, though they often speak in gentle terms. Even as Consciousness 3 tends to be very gentle with its most scathing condemnations, nevertheless, this bitter attack is explicit. An elderly man who had once been a scholar, who had now become a Hasid, was riding in the back of a wagon. The Balagala, the wagoneer, began to talk with him and began to apologize that his profession precluded his attendance with any degree of regularity in the Talmud circle in this little synagogue. The man answered him by indirection. He said to him, "Do you often give rides in your wagon to those who can't afford to pay?" The man said, "Often, of course." The one-time scholar turned Hasid, smiled at the Balagala, the wagoneer, and said simply, "Well, then you are truly serving God." One serves God in service to the poor. One serves God in extending oneself and being sympathetic in sacrificial act, in caring, not in ritual, not by amassing degrees, not by proving the cleverness of one's mind. Hasidic thought tends to speak of the world about as darkness. God is in exile. There are all about in this world of ours sparks of the divine glory. And it's man's responsibility to reach out and to uplift these sparks, to bring them out of darkness, to fan the flame, so that the darkness becomes light. How do we do it? Do it by walking into the dark, bitter darkness of a home, where there is anger and strife and contention, and by bringing laughter and by bringing love and by bringing compassion, warm the atmosphere, lighten the spirit, kindle lights in the living room of this home. Wherever one is, one can be a bearer of light, one who kindles life, one who shares one's own inner life, and who in that moment of sharing finds his own inner life burning the more brightly. There is no place so ugly, no place so destitute, no place so humble, no place so dark. There is not in that darkness an implicit light that one cannot find there service, the lighting of lights, a chance to light one's own inner being. And this is what Consciousness 3 is saying. There is no street. There is no backward part of this world. There is no peasant's hut. There is no cold water tenement. There is no wealthy apartment complex where there is not darkness, and where love, service, compassion cannot bring light. And that's the true service. Not the manipulation of people, not the management of power, not the organizing of five-year plans. The true service is in lightening the sparks that are under the shadow of the darkness. Consciousness 3 and Hasidism speak almost the same symbolic terms. And the terms speak of the moment. All that we do now. We can't know what the future will bring. More Cossacks, more war, more abuse of power. We can't plan for a future which will never be. Sacrifice ourselves for a retirement we may never enjoy and say, "That's when I will travel, that's when I will read, that's That's when I will visit my family. The moment is now. And it is now that we must fill this cup, this momentary cup.
What do you mean?
Moment is always with people. Always share. The way in which we share that moment, our ability to touch another, rather to live, rather than living walled in from all others as most of us do. That ability, Hasidim said, is critical, basic. Future, there will be a future perhaps. God will take care of the future. But the moment is now. And the deed must be done now, and the touching must be now, and the loving must be now, and the sharing must be now, and the caring must be now. There may be no other time, but now. Again, consciousness is real. Hasidim, speaking in the same language. I would remind you that it was not the student generation, your scholars, sense the beauty of life, new directions of the day. You mine this gold mine of Hasidic legend and Hasidic teaching, presented to the young. Much of what I've said appeals to you. It appeals to me. Because what Hasidism said essentially was that the world of form, world of work, the world of power is not enough to satisfy any of us. Real meaning of our lives is within the context of our relationships with others, particularly of those most precious intimacies of family and of deep friendship. And it is the way in which we live rather than the amount of achievement which we accumulate in the eyes of the outside world which validates our being. It is not how many initials you have after your name or how many inches of space you have in your obituary. You're dead then. How many people have been in life enlightened in spirit and made happier, made warmer, made more your human form? Having been you. That's the test. But there are no panaceas in life. There's no way which is the way, the only way, the full truth. The problem really with Hasidism is that though it reminds us to move beyond the formal, to move beyond the institutional, to move beyond our competitive urges, to see that there is more to life than the management of things, which speaks a very necessary counterpoint to the social, engineering, technological, scientific preconceptions of our society. Nevertheless, as it's taken over by the young, speaks a lesson which has within it its own innate confusions. The world that Heinrich Rentz described, the world of ignorance, the world of superstition, the world of fear, the world which denied itself the healing, the learning, the nursing, which modern society can offer to its people. This world was real. It was part of the reality of Hasidism. Just as it is real and true that in the Torah Karta, in the old sections of the city of Jerusalem, there are still Hasidic groups who deny the very existence of the Jewish state because it was not created through the agency of the supernatural Messiah. When you turn off the world, like it or not, you become a flotsam tossed about on the stormy seas of time. You take life at a greater risk than perhaps it need be taken. body and trust his body to a wonder-working rabbi instead of a surgeon. We trust the security of the state of Israel to the Messiah, of the body should come, rather than to diplomacy and soldiery state. Hasidism, taken to its logical conclusion, turning off, forces us to a fatalism, forces us to cast our burdens on the unknown and the unknowable, makes us play pigeons, if you will. World of the Hasidim, of course, was a world in which it was very clear what the terms of existence were. There was the halakha, there was the Talmudic law, and even though the scholar was no longer the paragon of all virtue, the law was scrupulously followed in every jot and tittle of it. In consciousness 3, on the other hand, there is no law. There is a disrespect for all ritual, for all right, for all description, institutional, legal, or otherwise, of what is the way men must go. And lacking this kind of framework, this Talmud, if you will, the young people in consciousness 3 have very little except some overlay in their consciousness of the old, humane, liberal, Western religious consciousness, which was conditioned into them in their childhood, to tell them what they ought to do. Hasidism has over-refracted it to them. Talk to them about intensity. Talk to them about the feeling. How we should do what we should do, but not what we should do. It never prescribed, it never defined, it never says, this is the way, these are the goals, this is right, this is wrong, this is what you must do, this is what you must do. And as the overlay, the conditioning of consciousness begins to disappear in consciousness 3, when people rely more and more on intuition, what? On compassion, what does it mean? You become more and more prone to the kind of erratic act, or the irresponsible act, or sometimes even the violent act, which most of us consider to be fundamentally immoral. It's very important to know how we do what we do, but it's also important to know what we do and what we should do, and what are the goals which we must seek. As I read of consciousness 3, I reminded myself that all the words which glorify intuition, compassion, feeling, spontaneity, genuineness. And Hitler too spoke of intuition and compassion and genuineness. He too knew instinctively what he must do. Teachings are only partial teachings. None of us feel secure, certain, that we know what we must do and how we must do it. Hasidism speaks to all of us. A feeling, compassion, warmth, what we most desperately need, fellowship, community. Beyond I and thou, beyond intimacy, beyond love, must there not be some larger organization of the society, some careful, meaningful social planning? Must there not be some meaningful, conscious organization of power? And must not all of us recognize that none of us can be Hasidic saints when we begin to organize. It's to the organized power or the good, or the larger good, the common we. Would we go back 50 years, this country, before we organized the New Deal? Or we reorganized the very structure of the economic order? Those who organized the New Deal were politicians. All of them were tainted. All of them were full of compromise. All of them played the game of politics. All of them manipulated men. But how much good, for how many, came out of that power game, if you will? Unfortunately, Consciousness 3 and Hasidism ask of men unworldly purity. The real world precludes any who are truly concerned words like justice and righteousness, equal opportunity, social order. But it's a remarkable and urgent reminder not to be bemused by what we do, by the institutions we organize, by the way in which we work to see a state be structured, so that we forget. Phrase in the Psalms, which I read to you this morning, which is perhaps the key phrase in all of Hasidic literature. Hol Rahav Da'im. Know him, acknowledge him, in all his ways. There is no work. There is no duty. There is no relationship. There is no meeting of people. But we cannot acknowledge God and find a chance to do the good, to lighten the lights, to be enlightened, or become